ba 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 ba. Welcome back to Time Smart Talk with Steve-O. You're listening to News Talk WLOB 1310. Barbara Ann, that's the theme music for our first guest. Please join me in welcoming Barbara McDade. Hey, Barbara.
Good morning.
Have you ever been introduced with Beach Boys before?
No, not on radio.
You may want to start, you know, everywhere you go. That could be your theme song.
I won a contest once because of Barbara Ann, but on KDKA Radio in Pittsburgh. Yes.
Small world. By the way, let me give you a proper introduction. Barbara is the director of Bangor Public Library, also known and active as president of the League of Women Voters of Maine, lives in Bangor. And thank you for making the trip down and being in the studio. I typically like to start these interviews with just a little bit of background in terms of, to me, it's always fascinating how people end up in Maine or if they're born in Maine and they come from away. So if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about what brought you to Maine, what brought you your interest in being a librarian, heading up the Bangor Library, and then we'll talk about the work that you're doing with the League of Women Voters.
Well, I guess I'll start with how I became a librarian, because that's why I came to Maine. I went to Juniata College in pre-law, expecting to be an attorney. And my senior year, I took a law course and found there was no justice in the law. And so I didn't know exactly what to do. And my brother was getting a master's degree. And he said, well, my place has a fellowship open. Why don't you come? And it was in special education. And so I went and interviewed, and they said, the guy that was just in here is a veteran, and we really have to give the fellowship to him. But library science has one. So I crossed campus and became a librarian.
The call of the Dewey Decimal System.
Actually, it fit very well, and I have just been delighted to be a librarian and come to be passionate about it, because it is such an important thing, although people don't seem to get it. But libraries change people's lives every single day. So I got my master's degree at the University of Pittsburgh. I became a reference librarian, then director of a library. Then I had a chance to start a public library in Virginia. I was there for 10 years and then thought I was bored and went to New Jersey, where I wasn't bored. I was actually sued for $1 billion by a homeless person.
Fantastic. Not that the homeless person sued you, but, you know, not every day you get sued for $1 billion.
That's right. And then I saw the ad for the Bangor Public Library, and I had heard of the Bangor Public Library.
Had you been to Maine before?
I had never been to Maine.
Wow.
And so I flew up to Maine, and they offered me the position, and I turned it down. And they called up and offered it to me again. I said, why am I living in New Jersey? I could be living in Maine. And so I came to Maine for the Bangor Public Library job. That was in 1991. And just delighted that I did that and ended up marrying a Mainer. So now I can't leave.
You know? Me too.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny? So many people either end up here or, you know, for the love of a good woman or man. That's funny. Yeah. So for 23 years, you've been the director of the Bangor Public Library. Is that right?
I have, yes.
Talk a little bit about Yeah, I think people can imagine that the director is basically the person running the administration and the operation. But talk a little bit about the Bangor Public Library in terms of the size, the scope, and the budget, and the services they offer up there.
I will. The Bangor Public Library is, I believe, the largest public library in the state. Portland and Bangor have this little rivalry going on, but they have branches, and we just have one building. We have about 525,000 volumes. We circulate over 500,000 books a year. About 820 people come through our doors every day. We have a staff of 37 bodies, which translate into about 29 point whatever full-time equivalents. It is the Area Research and Reference Center, which means it's the backup library for all libraries in the northeastern part of the state. And it has a budget of about $2 million.
great. So you've, in 23 years, and prior to being in Bangor, you were a librarian, as you mentioned, in New Jersey and some other places, Virginia. You have seen, you know, your time has completely straddled the digital era. So you've seen the library change, evolve, and morph from really just being paper and microfiche and that into the computer age. Talk a little bit about what that transition has been like over the last 23 years, and then bring us up to today in terms of the percentage of interactions you have at the library that involve paper and books and digital content, whether it's music or movies or ebooks, that type of thing. And then I'd love to hear your thoughts on the future, on what that means for the Bangor Public Library and other libraries around the state needing to adapt and evolve.
It certainly has been a time of change. I learned actually how to write to do library cards because we had card catalogs, and some card catalogs people still wrote and didn't use the typewriter.
God, I remember my first library card. I forget how old I was, but I was, you know, I grew up in Needham, Mass. And there was something special about going into the Needham Public Library with my mom and saying, okay, great, you're old enough. You're getting your own library card. It's like the first big, you know, later on you get a Social Security card, then a driver's license, and then other stuff. But for a young person, that's like the first official piece of identification that has real meaning. So that's special.
It is true, isn't it? And probably the first place you could go to by yourself.
Right.
All of these firsts that happen in libraries, it's pretty amazing.
Do you see in your experience a shifting in terms of public thinking about libraries? Because, you know, to me, one of the great benefits and values of public libraries are a couple things. One, the word public is in the name. It's inclusive. It's not a club. There's not an economic or socioeconomic barrier. Really, it is a place that in almost every community, and not every community has a public library, but, you know, for where there are public libraries, where you can walk in and not be judged and not have these barriers. But once you walk in, there's an infinite amount of information. Information leads to knowledge. And knowledge is really the currency of economic independence that gives people opportunity to find jobs, to look at schools, to educate themselves and create awareness. So it really is a vital platform. But do you see ages of people changing? Do you see the people who come into libraries in your work over the last two or three decades changing? Or is it fairly constant the role that a library plays in a community?
No, it's not constant at all. And yes, we are seeing changes. And unfortunately, it's the 20-somethings that we feel like we're missing. I think that they feel like they can get everything online. I think they're very savvy in using online, what's out there on the internet, but I think they need to look and check where they're getting their information from.
Well, we have a 20-something, early 30-something there. Shani, why don't you turn your mic there? There's nothing I like more than to put Shani on the spot. Shani, when was the last time you were in a public library? Okay, don't make faces. This is radio. People can't see you making a face.
It's probably been a couple years.
Like four, five? Longer?
When I was in school, so 2010.
2010, 4 years. Like, what's the barrier for, you know, you've got an iPhone or, right?
Yes.
So if you want information or you want to learn how to make apple strudel or you're looking for information on Bora Bora or something, you know, for an upcoming vacation, you probably look on your iPhone or your computer, right?
Exactly.
What do we need to do to get you back into a library?
I don't know. I love libraries. I love bookstores. I love books. I don't read books on Kindles or things like that. So I don't know. I don't have a good reason.
Is it time? Does it feel like, you know?
I am a little time poor.
But it is such an important resource. And not only is it about information, but it's also, I think, a congregation point of human enterprise. It's where we can get together. We have to be quiet because we go in the library, we go, psh, 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 psh. But it's a place where you can congregate with other people and share some proximity to humanity. How are libraries changing themselves over the next 5 or 10 years, do you think?
Well, like I said, we are in the midst of doing that. We're actually going to start the major renovations in August or September. So we are getting ready to have more exhibits, more concerts, and more civil discourse, which I think is important. We're rearranging spaces so students can come in and, as you say, work on things together, more cooperative space. We're also having a business center. We know in Bangor, for some reason, one side of Main Street cannot get high-speed internet access.
Like one side of the street?
I know. I don't understand. But anyway, so we get 1 gigabit coming in through the library, so we do have high-speed internet access. So we will have a business center that will have top-of-the-line printers, high-speed internet access, a 3D printer, programs that small businesses can use. Because we know right now that people, especially people that have home businesses, come to the library and they often update their websites.
Resumes, they research jobs.
Sure.
It's an important place to, you know, that creates opportunity and information.
But we know that people that have home businesses may not want their clients or their customers to come to their house. So the library, again, will offer this space where they can meet with their patrons, their clients. So we hope that that's going to be. But we're keeping our ear to the ground. We're going to offer space that someone may have a coffee bar or a juice bar in. So we want people in their 20s. We want to make sure.
Are we allowing Starbucks in yet? Because at one point there was a whole moratorium about bringing any kind of food or drink into libraries, and my librarian used to yell at me when I would bring soda. But are there places where you can have a Starbucks and come into the library?
Well, we're adding a front porch, a glassed-in front porch,
nice.
that people will be able to do that. But we also, we're a place for literacy for kids, for digital literacy, and as you said, a place to come search for jobs, a place for high-speed access if you can't afford it, a place to do all of those. We want to be the center of your community.
Okay. By the way, we have Barbara McDade, Director of Bangor Public Library, but she has dual roles. And she is also president of the League of Women Voters of Maine. So why don't, if you wouldn't mind, let's switch gears and talk a little bit. I'd like to talk on a broad sense on everyone. League of Women Voters are one of those terms which everyone's familiar with. You know, there's a general kind of amorphous sense of, oh, the League of Women Voters. But I don't know if there's a lot of detail understanding, both in terms of the history and the charter and the mandate. And so if you wouldn't mind, I know that it was established in 1920 after women, you know, in your brochure that you just handed me, it says after winning the right to vote for women. Even that seems absurd that women had to win the right to vote. You know,
and the men had to decide.
The men had to decide that women could, quote, win the right to vote and to be able to select their own representation, to be able to set policies that impacted their lives. So basically half of the population was kind of disenfranchised. And the thing that always amazes me and fascinates me and frustrates me about American history is our history is so relatively short compared to, you know, Egyptian pyramids, right? Compared to, you know, places in Europe where you go there and there's castles that are thousands of years, you know, we're just over 200 years old, 238 years old, something like that. So when you look at 1920, you're looking at a period less than a century. And there are people, obviously they were young, but there are women now who in their lifetimes lived in a country that didn't allow them to vote or their moms to vote or their sisters to vote. And it's just amazing to me. But if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about the background of the National Organization of League of Women Voters and the work and the mandate, and then we'll talk a little bit about the initiatives here in Maine and why it's important.
Sure. I actually, my grandmother was very strong on making sure that you always voted because she remembers when she couldn't vote. And you're right. That's just totally amazing. But the League of Women Voters grew directly out of the women's suffrage movement. The idea.
Can you explain the term, the women's suffrage? You know, again, I know these are rudimentary things, but for listeners, that it's one of those terms also that many people have heard, but may not know the origin or the context.
It means being able to vote, to be being a citizen of the country.
And suffrage is a term is the suffrage of being disenfranchised and not being able to vote.
No, it is not suffering, although they were suffering.
Right.
Suffrage really is that part that you can vote. So there's women's suffrage, black suffrage.
Right.
I know that many women are upset when we talk about the suffragettes, because that's kind of sounds diminutive, that they're suffragers or suffrage.
Right.
But women went out, and if you saw Iron Jaw Angels, you saw, you know, even in the United States, women were tortured. Women were force-fed. Women were arrested for going out and asking for the right to vote. This was a real fight, and it went on for many, many, many years. But when the amendment was passed and women could vote, then the same movement that fought for women's right to vote said, you know, we need educated voters. And so one of the first goals was first to educate women. This is how the mechanics work. This is these are your elected leaders. This is why you should vote. And out of that grew, I mean, it was the League of Women Voters, but now it's become, we have men members as well as women. We just, because as you say, people know the name League of Women Voters, although we're inclusive, we don't want to change that name because we have this great history. And one of the primary things that we do is educate voters. I'm sure you know, you remember the presidential debates before they got stupid, after they took them away from the League of Women Voters.
But League of Women Voters for years played a huge role in debates, right?
They did.
And then how did that change, in your opinion, in terms of what was the catalyst for the change? And
well, the parties decided that they wanted to decide how their candidates would be displayed. And so that's what happened.
And then they kind of hijacked the process where each party would say, we want to pick the network, we want to pick the moderator, we want to pick the format so that it's more advantageous to party candidates as opposed to the voters. So if the party, if the parties control how the information is presented, wouldn't they naturally present things in a way that serve their interest as opposed to the voters' interest?
Well, I think so.
I think so, too. And I'm running for office. I want to get more League of Women Voter debates and activation. And, boy, the party system, and again, I'm a Democrat, proud to be a Democrat in terms of my position on human rights and women's rights. But the party system itself is something that feels many times in both parties, there's almost dysfunction baked into it that perpetuates itself because the system creates and perpetuates the power that the people within the system have, as opposed to just being a platform to expose voters to information and candidates.
Steve, I don't think you're wrong. In fact, the Bangor League has just completed their third panel discussion on independent voters in the parties. And we've had independent candidates, we've had the three party officials, and then we had the two come together and talk to each other. Because, you know, the unenrolled candidates in Maine now are a larger group than either parties.
Just above a third, right? In the kind of mid-30s, something like that, depending on the...
Yes.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, I'm registered as a Democrat, but a few years ago I was unenrolled. In our state, and I think it's across the country, people, you know, I mean, you are correct, and obviously you're informed as the president of the League of Women Voters of Maine, that when you're unenrolled, people want to call that independent. And they say, oh, you're an independent, as if that's a thing or as if that's a brand. But really, it's you're unenrolled. And it's to me, it's funny how even the absence of being part of a party has kind of, in many ways, morphed into its own party that has some of the same pitfalls and some of the same issues that the party has itself.
Which is funny because the two people that we had Ben Grant and Jason Savage from the Democrats and Republicans talk last Friday, as a matter of fact, it was. And both of them said, oh, but it's, you know, we have these unenrolled people, but it's easy to start another party. Well, but that isn't what people want, I don't think.
And it's not another party. It's basically saying, and again, I like Ben Grant. He's chairman of the Democratic Party. Jason Savage is a Republican who's a close political ally to Governor LePage. I don't know him at all. But it's funny how in any system that where there's power involved or money, the people in the system fight so hard to perpetuate their own system. And there's such righteousness and indignation when people suggest that maybe the system could be either more inclusive or more open, right? And I'm sure in 1920, when the League of Women Voters came on the scene, 1918 and 19, there was resistance. People were like, oh, no. You know, I can't even imagine what the arguments were. I should look back on historical context, but there had to be men who were threatened of the idea of women voting, right?
Oh, well, absolutely. But I have to say, even closer up to date, I was only the third woman in the Rotary Club of Bangor. I mean, you know.
Wow.
It was not that long ago that women really weren't allowed in many places. And
yeah, it is so funny when you look at American history and you look on issues in terms of gender, you look at race. You know, recently Maine was at least in the forefront in terms of equality, in terms of right to marriage. But it's funny where when you look 100 years later, it just seems absurd. So it seems absurd right now with women. You know, I was born in the 50s, and in the 60s, I remember busing, and I remember great racial hurdles in Massachusetts and around the country and in Alabama and all the – and you look back and you go, that feels so egregiously wrong, and slavery seems so perverse to human nature, but within a couple of hundred years, these things, 160 years, existed. And you look back and you just go, how could that be, right? Whether it's slavery or women's right to vote or whether it's segregation in the 50s and 60s, sometimes it makes you wonder about the operating system of people, right? And again, and here in the U.S., we live in the greatest country in the world, and we are leaders in many of these things. And the tragedy is there are places around the globe right now where women don't have these same rights.
Or the right for education. Isn't that just disheartening?
And the right for education is the portal for independence and economic independence and freedom. And so I don't want to be too hard on our country, but you look at it and you go, how did anyone defend that 150 years ago? How did anyone with a straight face say, yeah, owning another person really seems like a good idea that we should support? I don't want to get too far off tangent, but it's just, I know we started to talk, by the way.
Sorry.
We have Barbara McDade here. You know, not only is she the director of the Bangor Public Library, she's also president of the League of Women Voters of Maine. Let's talk a little bit about here in Maine. You mentioned that you had a public forum with talking about the party system. But on a day-in and day-out business, and by the way, there's a website, www.lwvme.org, where stands for League Women Voters Maine, M-E, for more information. But what type of work? Is it more informational, educational in the process, or do you take active positions?
Well, I always start out saying that there are three things the League does, and then as I go along, I make it four, and so I can't think of the fourth right now. But the three are voter education is one of the primary things that we do, and we publish a statewide voter's guide with all the candidates listed. We started that several years ago with literacy volunteers. They are no longer helping us do that, but we're keeping it written on a fifth grade level so that it can really reach everyone in the state, and everyone can make choices. We still have candidate forums and debates on the local level or on statewide levels, and we're working on trying to see if we can do debates for the Senate, for the Congress, and for the governor, because this is going to be a big election this year. But we will definitely have the voter's guide, and that will be online or in paper. We do local debates and local guides. Then we also do studies, and we study things like the Bangor League is looking at the independent voter in the parties. We just did a study on agriculture. The Portland League, I can't remember what they're doing. I'm sorry. No. I won't tell you.
They're doing a lot of good work.
They are doing.
Portland is in the news. And, you know, my feeling about democracy in our government is that I'm an advocate for information education. And although I'm a Democrat and proud to be a Democrat, I grew up outside of Boston, kind of the shadow of the Kennedy compound. You know, to me, I don't have this partisan reflex to say we're right, everyone else is wrong, because I think the problems we face really require collaboration. Earlier today, I had the pleasure of interviewing Senator George Mitchell for an hour, talking about, you know, between he talked about working with Senator Edmund Muskie, and I look at Senator Muskie and Senator Mitchell as two of the faces on our Mount Rushmore, right, of politics.
Absolutely, yes.
And such a gracious man, a statesman, right? And even though he was enrolled in one party, he had this, you know, he talked about working with Bob Dole when Senator Mitchell became the head of the Senate. And we're missing that now because everyone wants to be contentious and fight each other. And I think the antidote for that is to get for the public to get more involved, become more informed and more educated, because it's in the vacuum of understanding things that people will believe anything. You know, people will believe that, oh yeah, climate change doesn't exist. Of course not, which seems ridiculous. Or some people will believe, oh, I guess President Obama was born in Kenya because somebody said on Fox News that, you know, his birth certificate wasn't filed or something like that. And the more we can get information, whether it's through the library, which you're part of, the Bangor Public Library, or through groups like the Women's League of Voters, we just need to, if we get the information out there, I'm fine with somebody if they want to be Republican, Democrat, Green, Libertarian, unenrolled, whatever, as long as the information is available and people can be informed.
That's what's important. And we're also making sure that voting rights stay in place. We fought very hard to retain same day registration, and we're looking at early voting, IRV voting. All of the mechanics of voting is something else that the league is very.
Have you taken a position on? Do you think we'll ever see a time when people can vote electronically by their own personal computer? Because one of the obstacles for many people voting, and it doesn't feel like a huge obstacle, but, you know, you have to jump in your car, you've got to get dressed, you got to, you know, get your hair right, because obviously I like to go out when my hair is looking right. So I'll make that self-directed. But, and then you go to the voting place and you check off your name. At some point when we have the technology and it's secure, because the big issue with voting is it's such a sacred right that there can't be any possibility of fraud or people electronically programming it so somebody, you know, gets votes that aren't really subscribed to them. But do you think we'll ever get to a point where a person can pull out their iPhone and just say, okay, I'm ready to vote for, you know, Mike Michoud as an example? Or do you think we'll always have a congregation point where we have to physically vote as part of the process?
I actually like going to the polls and physically voting, and right. I do it on the day. But I do think electronic voting will come. But you're right. We have to work out the issue of security, and we have to do confidentiality, too. Those are two things that we have to look at. The League is looking at those issues, as we have looked with voting machines. Those are priorities for us to make sure that the mechanics of voting are secure and trustworthy. I think the League, everyone in the League would like us all to trust government and trust that it works, because government is us in the United States. And and we need to trust that it will do the right things. And we need to think that money or power cannot dissuade us from doing right.
You just took the words right out of my mouth. By the way, we have Barbara McDade here. I say that all the time. When people say, oh, I don't trust politicians or government, we, voters, citizens, it is our democracy. It is 238 years old. People gave up their lives for the formation and for our country. And to this very day, and especially in Maine, where we have a very high percentage of military, both retirees and active military, people are putting their lives at stake for us on a day in and day basis. And at the very least, what we can do, to, in my opinion, to respect our own democracy is to be informed, whether it's on a local election, a county election, a state election, or federal. And not to do so, in my opinion only, is an insult, and it's a bit of a disgrace to be part of such a great democracy where so many people have sacrificed. So if there's a failure, I think more people should look inward and say, I maybe need to do more, I need to be more involved or more aware, and that becomes kind of the root issue. Right?
Absolutely right.
Oh, fantastic. This is, I'm going to have you, you know, write, you know, my views on this, because what you just said was absolutely perfect. By the way, I'd love to have you come back sometime. This has been such a pleasure having you here.
It's been very nice, but it is a long drive, I have to tell you.
It is. I know. I'm going up in a couple of weeks. We have the Democratic Convention up there in the brand new facility.
It's a beautiful, beautiful building. You'll love the Cross Center.
I can't wait. Well, thank you so much. We've had Barbara McDade here. She is the director of the Bangor Public Library, also president of the League of Women Voters. Their website is www.lwvme.org. Please visit the website for more information, and we look forward to having you back sometime soon.
Thank you so much, Steve.
You're welcome. You're listening to News Talk at WLOB 1310 AM, Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. We'll be back.